Hey, this is an interview between Karen Duder, and the date is the 28th of September, 1996. And could I ask for your full name, first of all? And your present address? How long have you lived here?
Since 1982, that would be 14 years. Mm.
And where were you born?
In Somerset, England. Mm.
And your date of birth? Was your mother also English? Your mother and your father English?
Yes, they were English.
And do you happen to know the year that they were born?
Not really, because they were killed in the air raids of London in 1941 when I was a teenager. And so I was not old enough to have ever really known when their birth date was.
Right. No sort of sense of roughly how old they were when you were born? Or?
I think that probably they were, I think my mother was late 20s and my father was early 30s. I'm guessing at that, but I approximately.
Okay, so you then immigrated to Canada on your own, not with your parents?
No, I immigrated with my husband in 1955.
Okay, what was your father's occupation before he died?
He was in the diplomatic service. And then he was in the service, in the army service, the forces, and he was in that up until the time he was killed, and my mother in 1941. So that but previously his occupation had been in the diplomatic service, British diplomatic service.
So he travelled overseas,
yes,
a bit?
Yes.
Oh, what kind of places did he get to go to?
Well, he was in the Middle East, and I think he spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East. But you see, I was very young when they were killed, so I was at school, and I'm asking you a question here. Are you going to be talking about schooling? You're going to have questions about that later,
yes.
So I won't enlarge upon it now. So I wasn't really old enough to know my parents' history, and I wasn't old enough to be interested in it. That usually comes when you get a bit old and you start checking into your pedigree. Huh.
Did your mother work before having a family?
No,
she didn't. Okay. And how many sisters and brothers did you
have?
I don't have any.
I'm only a child.
The schools, I'm sort of interested in the schools and if you attended college at all before 1960.
I was in a convent boarding school from age 7 to, all of my school life until college age, until I was 18. I finished at the convent with a BA, and then I was ready to go on to studies. But the circumstances of my family with not having my mother and father, all the plans changed, and at that time I didn't go to college. Career training will come later in the interview. But at that time I finished it at age 18.
Mm. So you were in a convent school. Which particular religious denomination was
that? Catholic,
there?
Roman Catholic.
Okay.
But I was not raised a Catholic. I was a Protestant who was one of 10 in the convent. There were 10 of us who were... is this pertinent to give you this on the tape? That in those days it was considered a convent education for girls was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And... So many Protestants sent their daughters to a convent for an education because they thought the nuns were very strict, and they were some of them, but battle actors. And we really had to watch our P's and Q's. So that was what it was, but I was not, along with the others, I was not raised a Catholic. We had religious instruction separately.
Mm. So you didn't have that within the school day, as it were? or you had that outside of the convent?
Well, the Church of England minister, the Church of England, like the United Church, he used to come to the school, and for the 10 of us who were Protestants, we would have our religious instruction right in the school. Mm. It would be assigned a space. I can't really recall whether it was on a Saturday or when it was. It possibly was on a weekend. Mm. And not during school time.
Okay, so you left at the age of 18, and how much after that did you get married?
I was 21 for 3 years. I had a grandmother who supposedly raised me the rest of the way after my parents had been killed. I was 12 at the time. And she was a ferocious old lady. As I said, she was one of those people that thought that children should be seen and not heard. And I couldn't wait to get away from her. And she died and left a lot of money. My grandfather died, and then she was a widow. And then when she died, she left her money to charity. I can't remember which charity she left it to now. Something like the Red Cross, some international charity. And she put in her will, I bequeath my congratulations on being such a forthright, enterprising, and independent young woman. So I didn't get a bean of the money, and I didn't care, because I was young and ready for life. And so that's what happened to my grandmother. So I was then on my own, and I fled to London, where all the action was, because I came from a little village in Somerset. I'd been closeted in a convent all those years and just got out on weekends and holidays. So I went to the big city and got myself a job, moved in. Oh, am I getting ahead of all your questions here?
We don't have to do anything in sequence. It's absolutely fine.
So I shared a flat with an apartment in a flat in England with two other girls. And I was a real country pumpkin. I didn't know anything about city life. I was absolutely raw. And these two were a little bit more worldly than I was. And one of them said, sometimes I do kind of float around with nothing on. Does that bother you? And I said, well, I guess not. You're feeling very uncertain about it. And she said, well, I tell you what, if I've got anything that anybody else hasn't got, just shoot the bugger off. So that settled that issue. And I've always remembered that. Look how many years ago it was. So that's how I started my career. So I'm going to stop talking now and let you ask the next question.
Okay. I was going to ask about the length of your marriage. And you did mention to me earlier, I think, that your husband died in 1982.
82. Mm, yeah. 29 years was the marriage.
And was he English then?
He was English, yes.
Okay, and what was his occupation?
He was an accountant, a banker. He worked in all the time in the bank. That's how we got to Toronto, because he was transferred.
Mm. And what was his, when the two of you were married, what was his age?
He was 31, and I was 21. That was 11 years difference. He must have been 32.
Okay.
I hope this is picking up the voice.
So can you tell me the number of children that you had?
I have two sons who grew up in England. And it's a sad story which I don't tell many people about, because it's one of those things that was a very sad part of my life. Here, that was brought about by my husband wanting the boys to have an English education, because he felt it was the best kind of education, particularly for a boy, and it created a lot of strife between us. And the boys did go and get their English education, but they also grew up English, and that's where they grew up, they married, and they stayed there, and they're still there to this day. So I don't dwell on it because it's, I mean, it happened a long time ago, but it still leaves a void that can never be filled. So that's the story on children. So as far as Canada is concerned, I have no children here.
Okay. Did you work after you were married?
Yes, I did. Yes, I worked for the government. I worked, well, in Toronto I worked for Family and Child Welfare and social agency. And I took my training for that, and I took business and personnel management because I got onto the administrative side because I was an organizer and a, I don't know why, I was a paper person. Everybody said I was really good at this paperwork where everybody else hated it. But anyway, it's why that is a strange thing will come later on, I think, when you get into one's personal achievements and what one likes to do. So I'll save the rest of that for later.
Okay, I want to ask you a few questions now about your own childhood. Just to reiterate that you don't have to answer any of these, should you wish not to, but did you enjoy your childhood generally?
I think so. So much of it was spent in the convent, but nevertheless I enjoyed it. I was a thin, scrawny little thing, very, very good at sports, because I was light and thin, and you know, the big, lumbering, hefty girls were way behind me. I played tennis, and I played all the things that you play at school. I was an artist, always been an artist. I was a gifted artist, and it was discovered when I was about 5. So I've always done that. I was very musical. From a very young age, I wanted to be a concert violinist. That was the dream of my life. And I did used to be taken to concerts. That's how I developed this interest. So I was given lessons when I was starting when I was 7. And until the Second World War put a stop to that. So I never got finished and I didn't become a concert violinist. Like many of us, I didn't realize my dream in those days. Carry on.
Mm. Out of everything in your childhood, what do you think you enjoyed the most?
I enjoyed anything creative. I think it's this artistic sense. I always wanted to draw. Also, I was very nature-oriented. I guess living in the country, I at an early age, I was encouraged to enjoy nature, and I used to go out on a lot of walks with my grandfather, actually. He was a countryman, and he taught me a lot of things, all about the trees and the wildflowers and nature generally. So I grew up with the appreciation of nature, a protective sense of what we now call ecology. And to this day, my greatest relaxation is to go for a day in the country, walk in the woods, walk on the beach, so that I'm still connected to the earth. And there's a very good reason for that. I'm a Taurus person, and I'm a typical Taurus. I don't know whether this is the right stage of the tape to bring out these little personal characteristics. But I'm a romantic, I'm a dreamer, I'm an artist, I'm an earth person, and I think I'm the epitome of a Taurus. Somebody once said to me, typical. And it wasn't too complimentary at the time because this person had had a rough time with the Taurus person. Anyway. That's another little aside.
Well, we left England when I was 2, so I don't remember it at all, but I hear that the Somerset countryside is gorgeous.
Very beautiful. Mm. And to this day, it's not too spoiled. It's one county that hasn't been overdeveloped. When I go over on visits, I go and visit some old relatives sometimes. An old aunt who's still got a privy at the end of the garden. In 1990, last time I was there in 94. Mm. Can you believe that? A privy at the end. And pouring with rain. You know, you've been sitting by the fire and you've gone on a visit in January to save money going in the high season. And you think, well, I just got to go down the path. And this is what they used to say. hang on a minute, I've just got to go down the garden path. So you get your coat on and your rain bonnet, put your umbrella up, and away you went down to the inn. And I used to come back and I'd say, you know, Aunt Ellen, couldn't you have an indoor bathroom? The council will pay, because they did. In modern times, nobody had to have an outside bathroom. And mind you, there was still the zinc bathtub that went in front of the kitchen stove. I tell you, it's unbelievable that people can still live like that. That's quite apart from the interview. Sorry about that.
That's fine. From everything that you've already told me, it's obvious that there were some more painful moments in your childhood. I was going to ask what you did not enjoy about your childhood.
I didn't enjoy my grandmother as my guardian. It's not until later years that I've been able to identify what any unhappiness I might have suffered was loneliness, I think, because being an only child and not having a family as such. If my grandmother couldn't have me in the holidays, I'd stay at the school, and all my friends would go off to wherever they went. And a few of the boarders would be left behind at the school, which wasn't a particularly inspiring kind of way to spend your summer holidays. But I would say that not having someone to play with, and I put that in quotes, not having close association, I could not have identified this in those years way back, but it's only in retrospect I can look back and say this, and it applies to a lot of older people. People were not demonstrative in those days. You didn't have affection. You didn't have a sense of belonging to somebody. Unless you were fortunate enough to have a loving family, and then you were part of this family unit. But a lot of kids weren't. And one-child families in those days, because the old Brits had a very strange approach to sex, you know. It wasn't quite nice. And so a lot of people didn't have children. There were a lot of childless couples. And those that did, there was the tendency the husband, people were not too happy about sex. The husband say, well, lie back, old girl, grit your teeth and do it for the empire. But of course, you know, there was no empire there. Couldn't use that as an argument. So maybe there was one child, you see. So there was this tendency to feel this kind of lack of warmth and part of a family unit. So, enough on that.
You've already mentioned that your grandmother was strict. Do you think this affected, for example, were you allowed to have friends around, or think this restricted your socializing
at all? Oh, yes. Oh, very much. You could only have who she approved of. If your friend happened to be somebody who came from the wrong side of the tracks, no, I don't mean that criminally. I mean, if your friend was a daughter of a farm laborer, then, or a son, or whatever, then that wasn't quite acceptable. You know, you were told not to play with those people. They're not quite our type of people. So that would, of course, curtail some of your enjoyment, because children don't have any sense of class, most of them. And I think that children will be friends with anybody that they can identify with and be on a friendly footing with for some reason or another. So I'm making these answers too long. I'm sorry. You're going to have take your hours to go through the tape.
Not at all. And it's actually a very interesting point that leads into a number of other questions that I have. Were there, for example, at your school, children from other racial groups?
None. They're all British, white and British.
And did you get a sense from your grandmother about whether or not you would have been allowed to play with children from other racial groups or perhaps other religious groups?
I don't think so, because of my age group, there were no other coloured people in Britain. They were all white. And if you saw an Indian from India with a turban, everybody turned around and stared. It was such an unusual sight, because even with the empire that was still lingering in those days, the colonials, as they were called, were not allowed to live in England. And so you didn't get to meet any other racial people. I never met any until I came to Canada. Then I did. Oh, no, that's not strictly true. I did in England in the 40s or 50s, when was it? During that 3-year period when I was in London after I was 18, there were a lot of Nigerian students came. And it was the first time I'd seen real black people. And so I was not really associated with them, but I had seen them.
Would you say that that religion was important in your childhood, important to your grandmother and in your upbringing?
Nuns who didn't take any nonsense from anybody and could hide behind those wonderful robes they used to wear and the sleeve, you know, hands tucked in the sleeves, and they would stand with great dignity, and there was always this, their boundaries were always very clear. You knew just how far you went with nuns. Unless it was a poor little novice who hadn't found out, you know, what she was supposed to do. And there were a number of them. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm making the answers too long.
Oh, no, not at all. Speaking about novices and their... How did the novices learn about their boundaries? I mean, to what extent how did you sort of test their boundaries? And was there a little bit of, you can be a little bit more, not naughty exactly with this one than with that one? Or
Yes, you could. You should find that out. The novices learned the hard way. They'd find themselves in the Mother Superior's office getting a real dressing down. And, of course, many of them were very soft and gentle when they first came into the convent. They hadn't learned the discipline, and they hadn't learned about particular friendships. And these romantic friendships were not allowed, and, of course, they hadn't learned that. And most of the girls didn't pay any attention to it anyway. And those of us who were lesbians and didn't know it, because we went happily along until we were caught at something. And then we too finished up in the Mother Superior's office and got a real lecture and a dressing down. And that made, and probably you're going to ask questions about that later on. Did I answer enough on novices?
I wondered how, I mean, you know, perhaps they were not strict enough. How much could you get away with in terms of misbehavior or
all kinds of things? Especially the girls who were much brighter than I was. Those who were the manipulators and who knew how to get what they wanted. Maybe one of the sisters had said absolutely not. And along came a little novice and they said, "Can you get me a this or a that?" You know, and this poor little. I think novices are fearful of, it's a very big step for them. It's a big career step into a community of women, and some of the nuns who've been nuns for a very long time, some are very nice and don't lose that warmth and ability to relate to people that some do. And for the novices, they can have a real hard time. But generally, a lot of them make it, and they learn. And of course, when they're getting near their novitiate, they're getting near the end, then, of course, the girls, the students learn that there's
vaccines they can't get away with anymore because the others are learning the ropes. So they've got to wait for the new batch to come in.
What kind of behaviours were not not considered sort of acceptable within the convent school?
Well, as one of the older nuns said, this unseemly behaviour is a disgrace to this institution. And the unseemly behaviour would be, of course, walking out in the village and making noise and being not wearing the uniform. There would be staying out, sneaking out of the convent at night, and well, that was unforgivable. You know, people would climb out of a window onto a branch of a tree and go skipping into the village, and maybe the village hall was having a dance or something, and or many of the girls used to do that. And they'd, or in the middle, at least 3 miles away, and they'd escape down there, and of course they were all sent back. And let's see what else there was. Bad behavior was being rude to the teachers, sisters, not applying oneself to one's studies, of course, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. People who cheated, that was unforgivable, as was in every school, unforgivable cheating. In general, lack of respect.
Mm.
And respect for the school rules, respect for discipline, and obedience. Mm. They expected unquestioned obedience. And if you could learn unquestioned obedience, then you've got it made, in other words. And I was such a model child, I must have been a crashing bore. I was so good, I was so, until I started to change after my parents were killed in the London air raids. I had an adventure about that. Maybe you might not want it on tape, but I can tell you some other time if you want to know about it. But I changed after that. I became more, I suppose today we would call it disturbed. I didn't have a family anchorage. I didn't have a comfort to embrace me after the tragedy of my parents being killed in those air raids. And I will tell you afterwards what happened. So that when I came back, I was sent back, brought back, to Somerset, I started a strange kind of behavior pattern of not wanting to obey and wanting to break every rule in the convent, and I was forever being hauled up. Mm. And I had all kinds of punishments. And yet it was so different from the child that had started there, this meek and mild poor little thing, that I went through this phase. And it was bad. I went through it for a year until they knocked it out of me. And so I've always thought it had something to do with that experience.
Mm. Do you think, were the nuns in any way accommodating the cause of the loss of your parents? Do you think that they understood, perhaps, that there was something?
One or two of them did, but some of them, including the Mother Superior, were of the stiff upper lip British variety. You know, daughters of soldiers don't give way to tears and feeling sorry for themselves. But there was a couple of the other nuns were much more motherly, and of course that's what I needed. That's what, I didn't know at the time that's what I needed and wanted. I can look back on it in retrospect, and I knew that's what I needed.
Mm.
But it wasn't to be, so of course I think this acting out, and of course after I went into family and social services, then I could see the behaviour patterns. I could see it in the children I was working with, and I thought, I was like that. And it's this, something is taken from your life. Parental marriage breakdown and the disintegration of home. And all those props are gone, and you're left on your own, and then you start to act out. And this is what it was.
Mm. During that difficult year, what were the kinds of penalties, if you like, when you did act out?
Loss of privileges. When they went on picnics, I would be left behind to help a teacher do out a cupboard or something. Or days out, fun days out. And of course, they knew I loved to ramble in the woods, and that was particularly heartwarming. So the others would be allowed to go, but whoever else might have also broken some rules was not allowed to go. So you'd see the whole gang trooping off, and you'd be left behind, which was very hard. It was very good punishment, really, because it went deep. It was much better than the thrashing. They never, ever hit us. And of course, that doesn't work anyway. You can beat a child into the ground, and they're never going to make them any better. In fact, it's going to make them worse. So, but those things, it's hitting where it hurts the most, and it's taking away a privilege, something a child is very important to a child.
Yeah. Yes, I was going to ask if they ever used the strap or the cane with girls.
I never did.
Mm.
Yeah, that was something that we can never do. One of them used to use a ruler, but she never struck a child with it. It used to put fear of God into you. She'd walk around the classroom, and you know, if you turned around to say something to somebody else, there would be this resounding smack down on the table. It would be this ruler would hit the desk, and if you can imagine, the flat rulers of the old days were not made like the junk they have now. They were made of hardwood, and it made a tremendous noise. You know, you'd jump around, and one withering look from the sister, and you didn't talk anymore. And they, a lot of you use this facial, this ability to control with facial looks. My grandmother did it. She never ever hit me, but she could get obedience by a look, a withering look. So that was used a lot in those days.
Mm. What kind of values do you think you came out of the school with?
Extreme honesty and truthfulness, because that was grumbling this. Oh, the tape's running, and I'm sorry, you're going to get a big blank there while I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking of values. I haven't really thought of values too much for a while. I had a great sense of wanting to move in a very protected environment. I couldn't have put it into words in those days, but I know when first I left school, the first time I went to London, I was very fearful of areas that weren't quite what I'd been used to, and I would scuttle into areas of the upper crusty kind of people because of the environment that I had grown up with, this protected environment. And I was fearful of the rougher kind of people, which I found in later years actually that were the ones that would have given you the shirt off their backs. They weren't the ones that were going to stab you in the back and manipulate you so often as some of the ones that we were taught were the nicer people. Not always the nicer people were the nicest. And so the values at the beginning were that I wanted to keep this level. I suppose I'd come out a little bit of a snob and felt I was, you know, I needed to stay with the upper kind of people. But it did change. And the other values I have mentioned was that I loved nature, and I felt that my religion was there, and I could always, even if I went to the park, there always had to be trees, there always had to be water, and I would gravitate to that. That was my prop. And the values I had were also that you didn't cheat people, that you tried to be thoughtful and considerate for others. You know, the things that you're taught that are rammed into you. So I came out with all these new, bright, polished kind of thoughts. And I was very trusting. I trusted people. I'm still like that to this day. I have been manipulated many a time. I've been hurt very badly because I trust people. And as some new friends have said, you should not be so trusting because sometimes your head will fall. So that's what I started out with.
Mm-hmm. Were those values affirmed by your grandparents, or did they have any different values that also had an influence on you, do you think?
I think as far as my, I say grandmother more because my grandfather died not too long after my parents were killed. I didn't like my grandmother. She was a cold, autocratic kind of person. And because she never ever hugged me, or I can't remember her kissing me, or kissing me goodnight or anything like that, I didn't particularly like her. She was an entity in my life because she was my legal guardian, but I didn't have to like her. So that from her I didn't get any values at all, not that I was aware of.
Mm.
Maybe I learned how to sit in the drawing room and balance a cup and saucer on my knee and a plate and a cake in the other, you know. But that's not my idea of particularly valuable value. So let's say I learned good manners from her. It was drummed into me and from the school.
Mm.
But I'm not sure where values and manners overlap. You know, I think there's a little overlapping there. But I think I've developed a lot more values since I got older and I grew up.
Were there any of her values that you feel that maybe you rebelled against a little bit, or?
Well, yes, I think I did, because her values were in the social class of people. She judged people by their social class, not by who they were. And I, at a very early age, could never understand this. I couldn't see that because people had money, or they lived in a big house, or they were considered upper crust people, that they, that made them more important, that they were important in her life. And I couldn't care less, because there were some of the girls in the school who had gotten there with scholarships and special reasons, that they came from the maybe farming families. And the snobby parents of the ones who paid big fees to send them to this school, they looked down upon these girls, and yet the girls themselves emerged from the school exactly the same as everybody else. So that their social position and their manners, their values, their discipline, their grades and schoolwork was always the same.
Mm.
The only difference was their own background.
Mm.
So that it's a very strange situation, because often those people, when they grow up, they've then got a new situation that they have to deal with, and that is their relationships to their lower class families. And some of them became snobs themselves because they'd associated well, and their value system was different. And many a family had some severe rifts, and many of those girls did not go back to those families. Some did, but a lot didn't. And they went on to greater things. They went on to university. They went on to higher kind of jobs or higher marriages. And so that class thing became a real problem for them. I'll wait for the next question. I hope this is coming out. I know my voice isn't very loud.
It'll be fine. What about your uniform? Did you have hat and,
oh,
and
yes.
Gloves?
Gloves.
Gloves?
Mm-hmm. Blazers with the beautiful crest on the pocket. Panama hat in the summer. Velour hat in the winter with the school band. Tie.
Mm-hmm.
Big clip on the tie. And pleated skirts. Our school has skirts, not what we call a gym slip. Did you have gym slips? Okay. That shapeless garment with the big box pleats in it, you know. So that when you did get a figure, it didn't really show too much. We had skirts and blouses.
Mm-hmm.
And if some girls were developing a bit more than the sisters thought they should, so they got them, you know, four sizes bigger blouses. I laugh when I think back on this. So uniforms, they became a symbol of this class system. In this context, they did. And you did not disgrace that uniform.
I was just going to say, would it be a no-no to go into town without your gloves on?
Oh, absolutely, without your hat on. Many of us used to tip it at an angle. Some of them would make it into what we called a pork pie hat. Here they call it a fedora or something like that. And we would shape it, you know, and shape, put it at an angle, in a jaunty angle. And if you met one of the sisters, oh!
What length, how low was the skirt cut?
Mid-knee, I think.
Mm.
My day, it was mid-knee.
Would any of the girls roll up the waistband to raise it up just a little bit?
Oh, heavens no. Oh, unthinkable. And, of course, they used to wear these, what I call bloomers underneath, the elastic and the pocket, navy blue. Mm. I think ours were brown, specially made for the school, for our uniform was brown and green. And into that pocket used to go candies and all sorts of little goodies. And I'm sure many of us, when we were younger, we'd want to get something. We'd lift up the skirt in the middle of the town and we'd go into this pocket for something and like, put your skirt down.
What about makeup? What was the attitude towards makeup?
Unforgivable. Nobody was allowed to wear makeup. But when we got older, when we got to 16, I think it was over 16, it was frowned upon, but we were allowed to go to the local hop and dance, as long as we were escorted and were chaperoned. Isn't that amazing in the 20th century? It had to be some of the other mothers or couples or whoever, these things. And I don't remember that we really were into makeup base. I don't think we ever put, because we had young skins, but mainly it was lipstick. And I think mascara was a very popular thing, because when we went to the movies and we saw the movie stars with big eyelashes, people used to smuggle this mascara in, and of course you'd see the girls come to the classroom with these big black eyelashes, blonde hair and black eyelashes. And maybe a little lipstick, thinking they could get away with it, but the sister would say, go out and wash your face. Imagine somebody of age 16 having to do that. And then you got the rebellion. Then it started. And there were some of them, they started to really rebel at that age. And they didn't see that they should be told to. And it was humiliation. And years later, I've thought, if only the nuns had told them after class, said nothing during class, but afterwards said that really the school rules do not allow makeup. Could you save makeup until after school? And it would have been much better.
Why do you think there was that rule? What do you think was what did the nuns think about makeup?
For nuns, of course, you get into that subject of sex. And one of the best books I've ever read, and you can imagine how much I would have enjoyed it, was The Lesbian Nuns Coming Out. Have you read it?
Yes.
For a person who spent all those years in a convent, I read this with relish, their stories. And of course, when I read it, I recognized some symptoms that I had seen. And in it, you will have seen the answers to a lot of these things, because different orders had different rules. Some of them were extremely strict, others were more lax. In the book, there were ex-nuns who had said that they were very happy in one place, but desperately unhappy in another, because it was suppression. And the rules were so strict that they couldn't be women, they couldn't feel, they couldn't do anything. So strict was the rule. But I think that in these very strict orders, sex was the big thing, and makeup represented sex. Mm. And throwing out, some lures. And this is what they saw as being dangerous. And so makeup was banned, as were indecent clothing or not enough clothing, and running around nude even in the showers. everything like that was discouraged, so that you did not show the body, you didn't, of course, touch yourself. And that was a very, very strict thing. And of course, with everybody, not just in a school, but in those times, and I mean today as well. You didn't touch yourself down there. You know, down there. We've often laughed about this, because every family has used it, down there. And so I think makeup and all these things that pertained in any way at all to sex were banned. They weren't talked about, they were not allowed, they were not even thought about.
How did your grandmother feel about makeup?
I can't recall that she ever had much to say to me, because when I left school, I only lived with her for about a year. And then she became ill and died. So during that year, I think I went out and about quite a bit with friends. I was a great horsewoman. I loved to ride, and I'd go out riding a lot. And so I can't recall spending that much time in her home. And I did wear lipstick. But in the country, you see, you didn't use a lot of makeup. If you were going horse riding, you didn't have to put lipstick and make your face up, but you did if you were going into town. And I did then.
So you obviously, you've said you went dancing. So dancing was okay.
Yes, well, of course, in those days, there was always chaperones for the younger, you know, the underage people. I mean, they were, of course, don't forget I was in the country, and to go to the village hall dance was a big deal. Or if you went into the local market town, that was an even bigger deal. But you always went with other people.
What kind of dances? What were the dances that you enjoyed the most then?
Well, there's only one kind. They did ballroom dancing. Mm. So I did. We were taught ballroom dancing at school, actually. That was one of the nice things. And I always had a great sense of rhythm and loved music. That was a very, very early thing in my life, was music. And at the school, they did encourage the music. And I was quite a bit of music in my program. And so I developed a love of music, and especially when they played the rhythmic music at the dances. I used to love the quick steps. And so, of course, I always danced with boys in those days. The women didn't dance that much. So I learned to dance, and in later years I also took ballroom dancing. Mm-hmm. And but so I've always enjoyed dancing. So that's nice.
What about some of the dances sort of just after the war? Was there any feeling about whether some dances were more appropriate than others? Whether there were some dances that were, say, a little bit risque?
Yeah, the palais, where you could go on your own and get picked up. That was considered very risky. Mm. And I went with a couple of girlfriends to one of those in London. And I thought, oh, I'm really living dangerously. I thought I'd really arrived when I went off to one of these. It was the first time in my life. Mind you, in those days, I never thought about it until recently, how safe we were. And it's a wonder we weren't all raped. Because we would be picked up by these fellows. They come over and ask you to dance, and then they say, oh, would you come out for a drink? And you go out for a drink, and maybe go to a restaurant. And, you know, on the whole, none of us seem to get into any kind of trouble. But what did happen was, when I went to work for the Kuwait Oil Company. Everybody knows about Kuwait since the war. And in those days, they were drilling up the oil. There was none of the big city that there is now. And I worked for a huge London office, this Kuwait Oil Company. Wonderful benefits, fabulous, because the money was rolling in. And one of the conditions of employment was that all women had to go and spend 2 years out of the Persian Gulf. Mm. And in those days, the accommodations were in sort of corrugated buildings at these, what they call them, Nissan huts or something. And they were this temporary housing, which was for staff. And there were 200 men to every woman out there. And one of the requirements was that every woman had to be taught judo to black belt standard, me included. And I became so good at it, I went to brown belt standard. I carried on and I thought, this is just a bit of all right. And they would it was a Japanese man who was teaching, and his assistant was looked like a samurai warrior. Big, hefty man. And here were all we women, we had to learn how to, self-defense and how to throw somebody. And what always amazed me was how it didn't matter how big a person was, once you learned this balance thing, you could flip a man, a 250-pound man over your shoulder and not bat an eyelid. So I learned this. And only once did I have to use it with a too frivolous boyfriend. It was in the back of a taxi, and I tipped him upside down the back of the taxi and opened the door and fled. But it was a nice thing to learn, and I've never forgotten it. Never. And if I'm out at night, I say to myself, if somebody came to mug me, would I remember? And I would. And so it was a very, very good thing to learn. And so the girl who learns judo can never be raped. And she can be stabbed, she can be shot, but she can't be raped. So that's why I'm always amazed that all the young women don't learn it now. It's too bad, because there wouldn't be the rapings and the assaults if they did. There's no way that people can beat you up, because 10 chances to one, he's going to finish up with a broken neck or a broken arm or a broken leg or broken something. I won't say what the something is, but there are ways and means. So, next question.
Would you, as a young adult or as a teenager, would you or any of your friends, do you think, have gone out dancing with a man who had been drinking?
I think they would have been fairly cautious. I think the people I went around with were taught enough that you are careful who you go out with. And there didn't seem that much drinking among the young people. I suppose there were some, but not the ones I associated with.
Did any of the girls at your school get pregnant before marriage?
If they did, it was so hushed up, nobody knew anything about it.
Now, did you get a sense from either the nuns or parents of what the response would have been had that happened?
Oh, yes. Because during visits to your home, at that time, people would refer to a woman or a girl who was flitting around as a loose woman, and she was, and of course another English expression was, she was fast.
Did you have that in New Zealand?
Yes. she was fast. And there was a tendency that you don't talk about that person any more than you talked about lesbians in the family. That was absolutely taboo. Nobody owned up to having any. So as far as somebody getting pregnant, it probably did happen. But we would, and she would have been removed from the school and carried off somewhere. You wouldn't have known about it.
What sort of subjects did you study at school?
Well, all the academic subjects that everybody studies, three R's, and then geometry, algebra, trigonometry, science, household management. What did we used to call that? They call it, what do they call it now?
home economics or domestic science.
Yes, well, we didn't, it wasn't called that, but we did study that. Domestic science, that sounds like it. Mm. That's more what it was. And we had music, art, which I excelled at and always pushed my marks up because I was an artist, horse riding. Hockey, grass hockey, tennis, other outdoor things that they have, swimming, a lot of sports, there was a lot of that, and I think pretty well everything that they have today, they did have then.
did you have a most favourite and a least favourite subject?
Yes, my least favourite was mathematics, as I was never any good at it. I was good at English and spelling and literature. I loved literature. In later years, I came to enjoy history. When I was young, I got bored with all the dates and the way history was taught. But when I got older, I found it a fascinating subject, especially medieval. That's my favourite period, was medieval.
What kind of, can you remember what kind of literature you read at school?
Well, we read the classics.